My castaway this week is an actress. Her face must be one of the best known on British television. Ever since she appeared with the comedian Arthur Haynes in his popular show back in the 60s, she's been in a succession of well-known long-running series. The newcomers, Are You Being Served, and its sequel Grace and Favour are just three of them. But it's a fourth which has brought her her greatest popularity. Ever since it first appeared on BBC One 10 years ago, she's played the part of Pauline Fowler in EastEnders. She is Wendy Richard. It must have been a big decision, though, Wendy, to take on that role, because it was completely different from anything you'd done before, wasn't it? From the vivacious Miss Brahms of Grace and Favour.
Yes, that's true. But I'd known Julia Smith since the 60s, and Julia and Tony Holland were the ones that dreamed us up, although Pauline and her family are real people. They actually exist. They're relations, I believe, of Tony Holland's. And Julia invited me to play the part of Pauline, and it was outlined to me that storyline, having the late baby and other things that were going to happen. And I thought, yes, this sounds good. And
why did you think it sounded good?
I don't know.
It sounded pretty depressing, I should think.
Well, I don't think it was depressing in the start, EastEnders. I just thought it was a good story, and I was happy, you know, to try it out.
But was it also partly that point in your career when you had to make the big decision to sort of stop being the vivacious blonde, the curvaceous
Miss
Brahms?
Oh, well,
Brahms,
obviously, you know, you can't go on playing those sort of roles forever. I thought it would give me the opportunity to show that I could act and show emotions other than those from A to B. You know, I could go a bit further, perhaps. And the biggest shock came to me was A, to have my hair cut, which was very long then. I didn't mind the fact that it was grey, but it was quite an attractive grey and
but
dark.
But they told you you had to have it cut off.
I had to have my hair cut off. And also I remember this well, writing a list of the makeup I used, which is, I try to use stuff that hasn't been tested on animals, right? So I wrote out this list for the makeup designer. And when I turned up for work, instead of all this list of different coloured eyeshadows and stuff I'd been used to wearing, I had, I think it was some mascara, a pot of base and some powder and a grey eyeliner, and that was it. And then you had to realise, you know, that the eyelashes and everything really had gone.
And then the wardrobe mistress presented you with all those cardigans.
There is nothing wrong with Pauline's cardigans. I'm sorry. I won't have this. They come from Marks and Spencer's. There's nothing wrong with Marks and Spencer's cardigans. And apart
from that,
it's just
the fact that they're cardigans.
Apart from that, I have to have somewhere to put my cigarettes and lighter. And if I'm not wearing a cardigan, they're tucked behind a picture on the sideboard.
So even after 10 years, you've got no desire to get rid of them?
Well, we're phasing them out a bit. I mean, Pauline has got three jackets. They get dusted off and brought out occasionally.
But do you feel very possessive about her, about Pauline? Do you say to the scriptwriters, she can't say that or she wouldn't do that?
Yes, I do. And I'm very possessive about my house. And sometimes, I think I could be digging my own grave here, when we get new designers coming, they come in and fiddle in my house. And I say, please don't do that, because that shouldn't be there. It has been there for 10 years and it's staying there. It's like the bowl of fruit on the table. Sometimes the cameraman will want it moved. And so the floor manager will say, should we take it away? Altogether, I said, that has been a focal point of my table for 10 years and it's not moving. You know, you'll have to adjust it or take a few bananas out or something, but it's staying. Because I think you've got to have a sense of continuity, and viewers want that because they notice.
Oh, they remember.
They really do. I mean, do you remember the flying ducks that were on the wall?
In Coronation Street.
Well, I remember watching the episode one night and Eddie Yates came in. As he shut the door, a duck fell off the wall while I watched Bernard Ewing's face, and full marks to him. There was just a slight quiver of the lip. If it had been me, I'd have been hysterical on the floor. They've had to go on again. Anyway, the next time I saw Coronation Street, the duck was back, but it had a plaster around its neck. I thought that was even wonderful.
OK, let's ship you off to this desert island. Tell me about your first record.
Well, I really would like Land of Hope and Glory. You see, I'm tone deaf. I can't sing at all. So if I'm on this desert island, no one can hear me. I can have a really good sing song. And, you know, you're not going to upset anyone with your singing or lack of singing ability.
Yeah.
audience at the last night of the prom singing Land of Hope and Glory with the BBC Symphony Chorus and Orchestra conducted by Sir Charles Groves. You're a pivotal figure in EastEnders, Wendy Richard. You've been there from the beginning. There aren't many who have, are there?
No, I think there's about five regulars left, and two of them, unfortunately, will be leaving for the end of the year. Sue Tully, who plays my daughter, Michelle, she'll be leaving later on this year. And then Bill Treacher, who plays my husband, Arthur, he'll be going, I think he's going in the new year.
So you'll be practically the only one left?
Out of my family, yes, yes. But I still have my son, Mark, but he wasn't there from day one.
But you're a very sympathetic character. You're a mum whose teenage daughter gets pregnant. You're a wife whose husband's had an affair and so on. Do you get many letters from viewers identifying with Pauline?
Oh, yes, very much so. Also, when Michelle told Pauline that she was expecting a baby, I remember the scene well. I was doing the ironing and I just sort of stopped ironing, just looked at the ironing board until it sort of sunk in. It sort of tried to give the thing of total disbelief, you can't believe it. And I had a letter from a young girl who said, thank you for that scene because I'm at school and I'm pregnant, and it gave me the courage to tell my mother. And fortunately, like you and Arthur, my mum and dad are standing by me. And
What about when Arthur had the affair?
Yes, it's amazing because you suddenly find out it might actually be happening to you in real life. You know what I mean? So you know, it comes as a bit of a shock because, you see, it was like when Michelle, they were going to make Michelle pregnant, and I went to Julie, I said, why is it my daughter? You know, Sharon's far more flighty. And they said, but it's the ones you least expect.
Well, you are possessive about it all then, aren't you?
Oh, I'm very proud of my family. I think my TV family are marvellous.
You were saying earlier on that EastEnders wasn't depressing in the beginning, I think was the phrase you used.
I didn't think it was, really. I mean, it opened with an action-packed episode. It was a good episode, the first
episode. But the implication is that it's a bit depressing now. I don't know whether depressing is the word, but certainly I think it prides itself on its gritty realism, doesn't
it? Oh, yes, and when we do an important storyline, which like the HIV thing with Mark Fowler, and what else did we do? Did adult education, because Mary the Punk couldn't read or write. And
you've done lesbianism and kidney transplants and abortion and adultery.
Yes, things like that do happen, and you must tell the story. We do have to every so often put across the public message, and that's what we do, and entertain at the same time.
You do have to put across a public message?
Yes, because when Mark Fowler told Pauline and Arthur he was HIV, I have to admit, I wasn't too clear about the difference between HIV and having AIDS. And their reaction was the same as most people who are unaware of the facts and what the difference between the two is. So we had to put that across.
So if you're going to deal with an issue, you've got to do it properly.
You have to do it properly. Because you're in great danger then of misleading the public. Because there are a lot of people that don't read a lot, do they? And they probably don't read all pamphlets and what have you in doctors' waiting rooms. So they don't understand. But they will sit and watch a television programme.
And how far does it mirror your life, your personal life? I mean you're a regular in your local, aren't you? And you enjoy a game of cribbage.
That's right.
I mean, so you feel at home in the Queen Vic. Is that all? Is it part of
you?
Well,
not really, because I can't have a game of crib in the Queen Vic. I'd be a lot happier when I had to sit there if I could play cards. But you see, you get people write to you and say, how different is, or even journalists say, how different is your life to Pauline's? Well, I mean, do us a favour. I'm a working actress. I live in the West End. Pauline's, and I have no children. Pauline's the mother of three children, and she lives in the East End. And I mean, poles apart, you know. Yes. I think it's a silly question.
Well, except that you go down the pub and sit there.
Oh, I don't spend all my time there, but I like to go and play, have my game
of cards. Chew the cud with your friends. So, I mean, there's part of you that identifies with that kind of
way
of life.
Yes, and also, when my parents were alive, I was brought up in the licensed trade. So.
But you dress better than Pauline.
Thank you.
And your accent isn't as strong, is it?
No.
Let's have record number two.
Well, I've chosen Glenn Miller in the Mood because I remember as a child watching the Glenn Miller story. I mean, doesn't it sort of make you sob your heart out at the end when she's sitting there at Christmas and he's not coming back? You know, they've lost him. And I think it's a brilliant piece of music. And the only time I really go out is to various charity functions, you know, and they usually have a very good show band on. And they nearly always play In the Mood. And it's one that really makes you want to get up and dance. Thank you.
Glenn Miller and In the Mood. So the accent is pretty much an affectation, but didn't you first make your name using a broad Cockney accent?
Oh, yes. I went to join this agency hoping to get work in commercials and what have you, not realising that it was Robert Stigwood who had pop stars on his books. And at the time, he had this idea to do this record with Mike Sarn, who was unknown as well. And they obviously thought that the song would be better if they had these interjections, you know, this dizzy bird sort of saying, I think, get lost and what for and things like that.
It was Come Outside, wasn't it?
It was Come Outside.
A kind of Cockney fellow trying to get this girl to go outside and have a kiss and a cuddle round the back.
And, I mean, I got paid very little. I think it was £15 and it sold over 500,000 copies. But I got a tremendous amount of publicity, which did me a lot of good.
It was a big hit, wasn't it?
It was, yes. It was number one for some time, I believe. And from that, I got my first TV series, which was Harper's West One. They were bringing in a new character, a blonde receptionist, dizzy blonde they wanted. And so they chose me.
What was Harper's West One?
It was about a department store. It was about the staff in the store. It wasn't like anything like Are You Being Served, because they were far more sensible. I mean, it was Jan Holder, it was terribly glamorous, which still is terribly glamorous. We had some good characters come in and out through
the
weeks.
Much more Harrods than Grace Brothers.
It was more Harrods than Grace Brothers, yes.
Yes, and you'd had some experience in real life, hadn't you? Didn't you work in a store?
Yes, when I first left boarding school, I went to work at Fortnum & Mason. I was the junior in the fashion department. And when you're that low in the pecking order, if one of the assistants had ever made a mistake, it was always you that got the flack, you know. So that stood me in good stead for being Miss Brahms later on.
How much did you earn, do you remember?
£3.08 and 4p a week.
But so you did that. You'd also trained as a beautician at some point.
Oh, no, later on when I was in between jobs early on in my career, I went and did a course with Estee Lauder. And so I've worked in Selfridges, Dickinson Jones, D.H. Evans, and there was one other, I've forgotten where it was.
All good research for Are You Being Served. But you did, and you also did some secretarial training, I think. Was this all because you didn't think you were going to make it as an actress?
No, that had nothing to do with it at all. I was away at boarding school. I went to the Royal Masonic School in Rickmansworth, and they tried to equip you in the best possible way to earn a living when you left school. If you weren't going on to university and everything, they had what they called a commercial form, which is what I went into. And so I did shorthand and typing.
Record number three.
Number three, well, this was a hymn that we had at school, which I loved, and that's Jerusalem. I think this is marvellous. I get very emotional when I hear this.
Jerusalem, sung by the choir of Winchester Cathedral with the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra conducted by David Hill. Going back to your beginnings, Wendy, you were apparently brought up in hotels, in quotes. What does that mean?
Well, because my parents were in the licence trade. That was the business they were in.
So you moved around a lot, did you?
Well, not a great deal, no. But, I mean, when I was born, at that time, my father had Corporation Hotel in Middlesbrough. But my mother was from Newcastle, the Hawley City, as they say. But Daddy hailed from St Albans originally. But most of my younger life, when I was at primary school and everything, we were living in Shepherd Market in Mayfair, and I went to school in Mount Street. I remember when the time came when we had to leave there, my mother sort of had to break the news to me, and she said, well, where would you like to go and live if you didn't live here? And I said, well, I'd really love to go and live in Ambridge with the Archers. And my mother then had to explain to me that they weren't real people. And I think it caused me more trauma than finding out that Daddy was really Santa Claus. You know, I mean, that really did my head in.
So you were hooked on soap even then?
Oh, absolutely.
Amazing,
absolutely, yes.
But then you had an awful shock, didn't you, when you were 11, because your father took his own life, didn't he?
Yes, but that was his choice, so.
But it was you who found him, wasn't it?
Well, yes, so he just looked as though he was asleep. which he was.
What effect, though, did that have on your life? Do you remember it as being a great turning point?
Well, it had the effect that... I think it affected my mother more. I mean, I went away, as I said, to the Masonic school. But then my mother, who was always worked very hard, she couldn't continue the business on her own because at the time we had a public house with two bars and a restaurant and an off-licence. It was too much for her. So she went off, instead of being, as it were, the governor's wife, if you want to use that expression, she went then to be a manageress for other people, which I think must have not been quite so nice for her when you're used to being in charge.
And what about your relationship with her? What did it do?
Oh, we were always very close.
And she was always supportive. You wanted to be an actress and she was happy.
Well, I think it was her more than I wanted. She wanted me to be an actress, I think.
Did she?
But she wasn't a stagey mum at all, not pushy, you know, like the one you see in Gypsy Rose. She wasn't like that at all.
But she liked the idea
of her. She was clean. I think she quite liked the idea.
Yeah, and so did she bask in your reflected glory when you did make it?
No, not at all. I mean, she worked very hard to get the money to send me to drama school. I was pleased that she saw some of my success before I lost Mummy in 72. And I had just done a cameo part in a film called Gumshoe with Albert Finney, and I got extremely good reviews for it. And I had the pleasure of taking my mother to Leicester Square and seeing a big coloured picture of me outside the cinema, you know, all lit up and everything. And so I think she realised then she had a return for her investment.
What was your first big job then? I mean, we've talked about the record, the Come Outside, and we talked about Harper's West One. But after that, what was the first big one?
Well, the first time I worked for David Croft would be early 60s, and I did Hugh and I for him. That was with Hugh Lloyd and Terry Scott. And then I went off to do The Newcomers, which was an early soap the BBC did.
What about the Arthur Haynes show? How did you get onto that?
Well, when I was doing Harper's West One, I was at the ATV studios, and I was sitting at a table in the canteen. These two gentlemen council made me sit here, and I said yes. And somebody said to me, I looked as though it would cost half a crown to speak to me. In those days, I was very snooty. And so they were talking sort of in front of me as I wasn't there. And the taller one of the two said, I think she'd be all right to play Arthur's daughter, don't you? And the other one was going, yes, I think so. So he said, what's your availability? So I said, we'll have to speak to my agent. And anyway, it transpired that one of the gentlemen was Johnny Spate, who wrote The Arthur Haynes Show, and the other was Michael Caine, who that week was playing a burglar in The Arthur Haynes Show. So they had this idea, Johnny had this idea for a sketch that Arthur has this attractive young daughter, and she comes home with this lord that she's picked up, and the lord was Nicholas Parsons. And Nicholas told me years later when I was doing Just a Minute that Johnny Spate had wanted Arthur to change the format and to go to doing a sitcom. And that was his idea for a sitcom for Arthur. And Arthur didn't want to change the format. He wanted to stay as he was doing sketches. So Johnny sort of shelved it. And, of course, later on it became Till Death Us Do Part.
With somebody else.
With somebody else entirely different.
And Eunice Dubbs, not you.
Yes.
Record number four.
Well, as I mentioned earlier on, David Croft, he's been a wonderful governor to me over the years, and I was fortunate enough to be in Dad's Army several times. And so I've chosen the theme music to that show because it brings back memories, and one memory sets off another, because if you're in Dad's Army, it was a privilege to work with such marvellous people. Unfortunately, I think there's only three of them left now. We've lost them all.
Who do you think you are kidding, Mr. Hitler, if you think we're on the run? We are the boys who will stop your little game. We are the boys who will make you think again. 'Cause who do you think you are kidding, Mr. Hitler, if you think old England's done?
Bud Flanagan singing Who Do You Think You're Kidding, Mr. Hitler, the theme tune from Dad's Army, which was written by David Croft. And Wendy Richard, my castaway, was in it. And you were also in on the buses up Pompey,
right.
So many of them. They all had live audiences, didn't
That's
they?
That's right, yes. I know in Are You Being Served, some of our laughs had to be edited out because they went on for too long.
And you used to wear dresses. You, Miss Brahms, wore a dress that the Princess of Wales had worn the week before.
Well,
something.
We had a wonderful costume designer called Roland Warne, who actually had been a dancer years ago. And we used to call him Roland Butter. Anyway, he was very in with what was the most popular thing or would be really topical to have that week, because when the Queen did Prince Charles' investiture as Prince of Wales, and she wore this yellow outfit with those things on the back of the hat, remember? Those
the plumes.
Yes. Yeah. Mrs. Slocum had that the following week. Then the Princess of Wales was seen in the most beautiful black strapless gown. I had that when we went to the opera. It was so nice. It's funny, because going back to Pauline, I don't mind dressing as Pauline does. That doesn't bother me. But when we did Are You Being Served, you knew you were going to dress up in something either fantastic or quite ridiculous at least once a week.
But it was good fun.
It was good fun.
It's playing in the States at the moment, isn't it?
Yes, I was in New York in March of 94, and was amazed to find out I was on television three nights a week.
Do you think all of that comedy that you've done through your career and all the titles we've mentioned, how do you think it compares with television comedy today?
Well, I always thought the BBC made the best comedy in the world, but I'm afraid it's not the case anymore. It's, you see, if you put on Dad's Army or you put on Steptoe and Son, Fawlty Towers,
they still
it goes
do.
Straight up in the ratings. But I'm afraid some of these young so-called stand-up comics, they can't hold a candle to, well, we'll never see the like of Fraggie Howe and Tommy Cooper, Morecambe and Wise again. That's obvious.
Do you think you're bound to say that because that was your era, as it were?
No, but it's true. If you chat to people, those are the sort of shows that they like. I remember the two Ronnies used to have wonderful dancing and good music and costumes, and there was never anything offensive in those shows at all. Same as Are You Being Served? It was all self-cleaning jokes.
Record number five.
Number five. I love this piece of music. It's the Flower Duet from Lakme. I think it's lovely.
Joan Sutherland and Jane Berbier singing the Flower Duet from Lakme by Delib with the National Orchestra of Monte Carlo, conducted by Richard Bonning. How are you going to cope on your desert island, Wendy?
Well, if I can't take my dog, Shirley Brahms II, I'm not playing at all. You let Princess Michael take her cats, I'm taking my dog.
I didn't let Princess Michael take
Well, somebody
her.
Did.
I gather there's been some prior negotiation about this, but you can't take alive anything other than yourself.
Oh, well, you should tell me that at the beginning, you see.
And you wouldn't have come.
I wouldn't have come, no.
But why is the dog such a life and death business?
Well, because
what
she's
is
my
she?
Best friend. Oh, she's a lovely little Cairn Terrier, and I got her when we were doing Grace and Favour up in Gloucestershire. And that's why she's Shirley Brahms II. She actually has appeared on television. She was in Grace and Favour. She played a guard dog for a farm. And she had this scene with John Inman. Of course, she knows John. So as soon as he appeared, she rolled flat on her back for him to tickle her tummy. But anyway, it was quite good. And she gets fan mail, which I have to answer. And
she's your best friend.
She's my best friend, yes.
Well, what do you mean by that?
Well, because she's always with me. And she does funny things, so she'd keep me amused.
So you'd be lonely without her?
Oh, I would, desperately.
Otherwise, is life on your own manageable?
Oh, yes. Yes, I might have a bit of trouble if I've got some heavy garden rubbish to carry out, but I can always find someone to do that for me.
You've been married three times, and you haven't found happiness. I mean, do you find that depressing? Or
no, in fact, at the moment, I'm a lot happier than I've ever been. And everybody tells me how well I look. I've got no stress anymore.
So you're happy to go on your own?
Yes.
You're not
yes.
looking for number four?
No, no.
Shirley will do.
Yep.
Except that she's not coming to this desert island.
Oh, well now, I'm sorry, I'm not going then.
Tell me about your next record,
if you're going to start
quick.
Moving the goalposts. Well, I remember seeing an old black and white movie many years ago, and it was called Bolero, and it was George Raft. And I remember thinking, oh, he's one of the most handsome men I'd ever seen. I think I was about 12 at the time, and I thought, gosh, he's so handsome. I didn't realise what a fantastic... apart from playing villains and everything, he was a fantastic dancer. And this is a beautiful piece of music. And again, you see, you can sit and listen to this, and you can imagine all sorts of wonderful pictures. You just let your mind travel on.
Part of Ravel's Bolero, played by the London Philharmonic, conducted by Andrew Lytton. How much of your life, Wendy, is taken up by EastEnders now?
Well, quite a lot. I've got a stack of books by the side of my bed which I haven't got round to reading yet, because next to it are a stack of scripts, and because we've now changed our format of working, we do rehearse, record, so you really have got to be on the ball and make sure you know your lines.
So you're out at Elstree how many days a week?
Five at the moment, but longer hours. But sometimes, if someone's off sick or something, then you have to go in, so you have to do a Saturday.
And you've got your own fridge and your own kettle.
Oh, in my little dressing room, yes. I've got a fridge and a kettle and a radio, because I do make a blinding cup of tea.
And you've got your salads in the fridge. I mean,
that's
you look
right.
after yourself.
Yes.
And Shirley by your side. Does life go on and on like that? Is it fulfilling, or do you see yourself jumping off the bandwagon at some point?
I don't see myself leaving EastEnders just yet. I'm under contract for another 12 months.
Is that what you get, a 12-month contract
yes,
at a time?
Yes,
and you say it's very much a team. Is it more than a team? Is it a family? Are you self-supporting?
Well, yes, it is. And we all care about each other. I haven't got any brothers or sisters, but I would imagine if you have... Well, I know from my friends who have brothers and sisters, every so often they might fall out, but they're back together again because you're united, aren't
yes.
you?
And you've also got the pressure that you all suffer, which presumably unites you, which is that the press always want to know. I mean, because you have mass audience appeal, the press always want to know what's going on, and they always want the inside stories on you all
I
as
know,
well.
I'm not the biggest fan of the press, I'm afraid.
How intrusive does it get?
Well, it can get very intrusive because, I mean, if you've ever been doorstepped by the press, I tell you, it is most unpleasant. And I was trying to walk my dog once, and there's about four reporters and three photographers, and, of course, she wouldn't spend a penny with this great audience. And I said, well, just at least let me walk the dog, you know. I've nothing to say to you, really wasting your time.
Record number seven.
Well, as I said earlier on, The Archers... I mean, I was brought up with them, and that is my 1 hour on a Sunday morning that is mine. And I might be baking something in the kitchen, or I might sit down and do my tapestry, and that 1 hour is mine. And that's I don't even pick my lines up for that hour, because you have to learn your lines on a Sunday. And I think they're all absolutely marvellous. I'm a life member of the fan club. When you hear this music... It reminds you of Sunday lunch when you were little, you know, Sunday mornings, because at Sunday lunchtime you then had Life of the Lions and Ted Ray and all that, but in the morning was The Archers. And so it brings back memories of all that, but I will have to arrange for someone to send me a tape every week in a bottle of the omnibus edition of The Archers. Thank you.
Green, the theme tune of The Archers. So you listen to The Archers, you obviously watch Coronation Street, as well as knowing everything that's going on in EastEnders. What about all the others? What about Brookside, for example?
I used to watch Brookside. I thought Sue Johnson is a marvellous actress, and after she left, I didn't watch it anymore.
But again, thinking about The Archers, life is pretty mundane in Ambridge, unlike in Albert Square, as we were discussing.
Oh, I don't know. I tell you what, when she was in prison, Susan, I said to one of the set designers at work, I said, can I have a bit of graffiti in the laundrette? So he said, well, what do you want to write? I said, free the Ambridge One. And he said, oh, Wendy, I'd love to. He said, but I couldn't, but I did want to write Free the Ambridge One. I just wanted to put my little protest in.
But do you still look forward to the next script of EastEnders coming through the door to find out what happens to you?
Yes. I always look forward to see if I've got sitting down scenes, because I hate standing up for hours on end. And I'm not a great fan of props. We had a lovely man come to direct us, I think it was last year. He's back again now, because I left a note on his desk, because he turned up on the lot. It was his first day with me. And I was standing outside the laundrette, and he put his broom in my hand, and I looked at him. So I said, what's this for? He said, well, I thought I might have you sweeping the pavement, you know, instead of Arthur. So I just looked at him, and Brian, the props bloke, took the broom away. He said, I told you she wouldn't do it. And he walked off with the broom, and we were just left looking at each other, you know.
Well, now, on this island, no one is going to be left in any doubt about what you're really like, because you're deeply patriotic, I can tell.
Yes.
You better tell us what the last record is.
Well, this is another good sing-song, and I thought I could knock a chair together for myself, and I would sit there on the beach looking out at the sea, and I'd have this blaring out, and that's Rule Britannia.
Britannia with Anne Collins and the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra and Choir, conducted by Sir Charles Groves. If you could only take one of those eight records, Wendy, which one would it be?
Land of Hope and Glory. I could then sit in my chair on the beach again and sing that.
They're all big belters, really, aren't they?
Yes, yes.
What about your book?
Well, there's not many authors I've read more than once, but there's one, and I laugh out loud every time I read his stuff, and that's Tom Sharp. So if I could have all his books in one big volume...
Oh, that's breaking
they're not,
another
no,
rule.
Just a minute, they're not that big. They're not that big. You could get a Reader's Digest compendium of them, or whatever it's called.
But name me your favourite one.
I think Wilt, because, God, you must have some sort of imagination to write a story like that.
Wilt, OK. Well, we'll see if we can sneak the compendium in as well. But Wilt it is. What about your luxury?
Well, here I have a bit of a problem now. Do I take a manicure set? I'm not bothered about not having a drink, but what about my cigarettes and my filters for my cigarette holder? Or do I take all my unfinished tapestries from home?
Well, there's one thing for sure. You can only take one of those things.
Could I not roll a few packets of fags up in my tapestries and take them?
Or the dog.
I'll take the tapestries.
Wendy Richard, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you very much.